I was watching TV. I don't know if you've had this happen. I wouldn't be surprised if you had. One of those commercials came on. I don't even know what they advertised, but they show various athletes working out. And I mean, they are working out. They're pushing themselves mercilessly and displaying incredible, finely honed athletic skill. But, you know, they're sprinting and they're lifting weights so hard and they're just, you know, making it happen. And every time I see that, something in me goes, yeah, I want to do that. I need to push myself. I want to get in that kind of shape. You know, I need to get out there and really work hard. And then I think, nah, what I want to do is eat a donut, you know. But I try not to give into that tempting voice. But I do have to come back to earth and realize, you know, no matter what I do at this point in my life, I'm never going to look like those athletes. Actually, I never would have any time in my life. And I'm certainly never going to be in the kind of shape they're in. But there's another part of it that's even worse. And that is that I realize now that if I even try to go out and work as hard as those people do, what I'm going to do is injure myself. Earlier this year, Lori and I committed to a workout regimen that was a good deal more rigorous than we had been doing. It was an 8-week program. Now, not anywhere nearly as extreme as those things you see on the commercial, but it was definitely a big-time escalation for us. So we did that, and we made it through that 8-week program. At the end of that 8-week program, I guess I was maybe in a little better condition, but I didn't look much different. You know, wasn't in much better shape. But the bigger problem was stuff was hurting. Yeah. My left hip was hurting. I never have trouble with my hip joints. My hip was hurting. Both my knees, which I don't have problems, they were just barking at me big time. My shoulder was hurting. And, you know, these weren't the kinds of injuries that, well, you know, if you just push through that, they'll get better. These were overuse injuries. That the only way they got better was by stopping. And, you know, when you have something like that happen, after a while you start thinking, why do I even try? Trying harder just ends up with me not improving any, but actually hurting myself. I might as well just give up. Now, the sermon I want to preach this morning isn't about physical conditioning. It's about something that's analogous to that that happens in the spiritual realm as well. That we can actually do a similar kind of thing spiritually and end up actually giving up because of what we've been trying to accomplish in our spiritual lives. We're going to look at an incident that takes place in the life of David. We're continuing our study of the life of David. We're in 2 Samuel chapter 5 this morning, where we're going to see a big-time turning point in David's life, a good, great, and positive thing that happens. But in the course of seeing this thing happen, there's something unusual we're going to notice. So I'm going to ask a kind of a curious question. And the answer to that question becomes critical for us if we long to have spiritual health. So let's look at 2 Samuel chapter 5. All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "We are your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And the Lord said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler.' When all the elders of Israel had come to David at Hebron, the king made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years. The king and his men marched to Jerusalem to attack the Jebusites who lived there. The Jebusites said to David, 'You will not get in here. Even the blind and the lame can ward you off.' They thought, 'David can't get in here.' Nevertheless, David captured the fortress of Zion, which is the city of David. On that day, David had said, 'Anyone who conquers the Jebusites will have to use the water shaft to reach those lame and blind who are David's enemies.' And that is why they say, 'The blind and lame will not enter the palace.' David then took up the residence in the fortress and called it the City of David. He built up the area around it from the terraces inward, and he became more and more powerful because the Lord God Almighty was with him. Now Hiram, king of Tyre, sent envoys to David along with cedar logs and carpenters and stonemasons. They built a palace for David. And then David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel and exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. After he left Hebron, David took more concubines and wives in Jerusalem, and more sons and daughters were born to him. These are the names of the children born to him there: Shammua, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, Ibhar, Elishua, Nepheg, Japhia, Elishama, Eliada, and Eliphelet. Great. Glad to know all that. Okay. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, they went up in full force to search for him, but David heard about it and went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines had come out and spread in the valley of Rephaim. So David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go and attack the Philistines? Will you deliver them into my hands?" The Lord answered him, "Go, for I will surely deliver the Philistines into your hands." So David went to Baal Perazim, and there he defeated them. He said, "As waters break out, the Lord has broken out against my enemies before me." So that place was called Baal Perazim. The Philistines abandoned their idols there, and David and his men carried them off. Once more, the Philistines came up and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. So David inquired of the Lord, and he answered, "Do not go straight up, but circle around behind them and attack them in front of the poplar trees. As soon as you hear the sound of marching, the tops of the poplar trees move quickly, because that will mean the Lord has gone out in front of you to strike the Philistine army." So David did as the Lord commanded him, and he struck down the Philistines all the way from Gibeon to Gezer. Okay, that's good enough. So what we see happen here is David finally became king. We saw in 2 Samuel chapter 1 that David learned that Saul, who had made his life miserable for so long, had died. By 2 Samuel chapter 5, by this time, a lot of water now has passed under the bridge since Samuel, the prophet, had first anointed David to be the next king of Israel. David has killed the mighty warrior Goliath. He's become a part of the royal court. He has married the king's daughter. He's become a military hero. He spent years on the run from an insane king who was obsessed with killing him, lived in caves and wilderness areas, gathered his own private army, and twice he fled to enemy territory to escape Saul. And finally, we find in 2 Samuel 2, chapter 4, we learn that after Saul's death, David settled in Hebron, which is in southern Israel, in the tribe of Judah area, and then there the leaders of the tribe of Judah came and anointed him king over Judah. Now, that was nice, but it presented a problem. Israel was supposed to be one nation, a confederation of 12 tribes, but now one of its tribes was declaring this man to be their king, regardless of what everybody else did. Now, imagine what would happen if, say, Texas this year said, "You know, we don't like either one of the candidates that are being presented to us, so we're going to elect our own president, and we don't care who your president is." Yeah, okay. Okay. You probably have a lot of company, but, you know, how do you suppose that would go? Probably wouldn't go out too well, because that issue kind of got settled back in the 1860s. But that's the kind of situation that has been set up here with Israel. Now Judah's got their own king. What's going to happen? You know, there was concern that Israel was just going to fracture into a group of tribes again. Now, one of Saul's sons was still alive. And that day, of course, the way power was transferred was from father to son, or a king got assassinated and the assassin took over. Saul's death, leaving one son, you would legitimately think, well, probably his remaining son is going to become the king. There was a guy named Abner who was actually Saul's top general, who decided that he wanted to continue being the top military officer in all of Israel, and really kind of the power behind the throne. And so this one remaining son, this guy Abner, decided, "I'm going to prop him up as the next king of Israel." That guy's called in this chapter Ish-bosheth, in 2 Samuel. Ish-bosheth actually probably wasn't his name, because it means man of shame. you're thinking probably somebody's not going to name his son. Oh, this is my son, shameful, you know. So it was probably a play, a pun on his name. We don't know what his name really was, but it was a description of his character. Could have been running for president this year in our country. But anyway, he is no leader. In fact, he shows up in 2 Samuel as kind of a puppet, a weak guy, Abner's puppet. And there's a, when you look at the account of Saul's death, there's a little notice that it's easy to miss that suggests that Ishbosheth really earned the name Man of Shame. And 1 Samuel chapter 31, verse 6, after verse 5 tells us how Saul died, you read this. So Saul and his three sons and his armor bearer and all his men died together that same day. Saul and his three sons all died. Where's Ishbosheth? He's not mentioned. It does say Saul and three of his sons, but Saul and his three sons, Ishbosheth wasn't there. Probably wasn't fighting for Israel. May have been why he was called Man of Shame. We don't really know. Something about his character really was not good. But this guy, Abner, decides, well, he's Saul's son, so we'll make him king. Well, now you've got Ishbosheth propped up by Abner as king candidate, and then you've got David propped up by Judah as a king candidate. What do you think is going to happen? Civil war. And that's what happened. There was a war that went on. 2 Samuel chapter 3 verse 1 says, the war between the house of Saul and the house of David lasted a long time. David grew stronger and stronger while the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. So you've got a war going between Abner and Ishbosheth on one side and Saul and David and his on the other side. David just gets stronger and stronger. Now at one point, things turn really bad for Ishbosheth when Abner is killed. Not long after that, two of the military leaders under Ishbosheth, guys who were led raiding groups, decided they were on the wrong side and that they needed to switch sides and to do it dramatically. And so they snuck into Ishbosheth's house while he was asleep and they assassinated him, thinking that David would be pleased. David was incensed. And the amazing thing we saw about David last week was, even after all this time, he had great respect for Saul. And he had huge respect for Saul's descendants. And he was furious that these guys had assassinated Saul's sole remaining heir. He executed them both. However, with Ishbosheth dead and Abner dead, there's no more civil war. So we see here in this chapter, finally, everybody comes together and says, David, you're the man. We know God has called you to be the king, and we all recognize you are now the king of Israel. 30 years old, David finally became king. Now, the second thing you see David do in this chapter is he conquered Jerusalem. David realized that because he was from Judah, which is in the south, and he's now living in Hebron, which is in the south, he's going to have a problem with ruling the entire nation of Israel from a southern city. If he did that, he would be viewed as a purely southern king, y'all. And so, got to do something else. So he figures out, I need to have a different city as my capital. Now, Jerusalem was in central Israel and presented a great opportunity as the capital city. It was on the heights, and so it was a very defensible position. So David seized on Jerusalem as a great place to make his capital. Now, the interesting thing for us, because we associate Jerusalem with Israel continually and think of it as the city of David, it's hard for us to realize that in David's day, at that point, before he became king, it was just another Canaanite city. The Israelis actually had never been able to occupy it, and it was occupied by a Canaanite group called the Jebusites. And Israel, it was kind of neutral territory for them because none of the tribes had ever been able to conquer it. So David says, you know, it's in a great location, it's defensible, it's in the center, it would be the perfect place for a capital. All I need to do is capture it. But that was a problem because it was a very defensible position. In fact, as David came to lay siege to it, the people that lived there, the Jebusites, said, you know, even our blind and our lame could defeat you because you have no chance of getting in here, David. We're not worried about you at all. Now, this what happened next would have made a cool movie because, first of all, because we don't have a lot of details, so Hollywood could do what they're really good at, which is make up a whole bunch of wild stories out of nothing about it. But what happens is David figures out a way to conquer Jerusalem, and they did it by going through some of the tunnels that were used to supply water to the city. It's interesting, in 2008, a well-known Israeli archaeologist, Dr. Eilat Mazar, discovered what she believes to be the ancient tunnel that David used to invade the city of Jerusalem. So David sent his men in through this tunnel. The defenses, of course, of Jerusalem were all looking out towards people coming from outside. They got inside and surprised the Jebusites and conquered them. And so it's interesting. It says that that became a saying, the blind and lame will not enter this house. This, our translation says palace. Literally, it's the blind and lame will not enter this house. We're not exactly clear how that was used, but my guess, and it's only a guess, was that it was an ironic taunt of that they would use of a supposedly superior opponent. Maybe you've seen, using commercials this morning, have you seen the State Farm commercial where Clay Matthews, the Green Bay Packers linebacker, and Aaron Rodgers, their quarterback, are in the locker room, and they're pumping up their teammates, and they say, no one can enter this house without paying the price. Not here, not ever. And then, you know, all the guys are going, you protect this house, you know. And then the next scene, they showed those same two guys at home, and Rodgers spots a bee on a plate, and he goes, no one comes into this house without paying the price. Not here, not ever. And he attacks it with a golf club. Sort of the way Lori would react to a spider in our house, you know. But then he loses control of it and the golf club goes through a window. Anyway, that's kind of the thing. You're not going to enter this house. Not now, not ever. Not even you blind and lame who supposedly could defeat David. Yeah, you can't come in this house. Not without paying a price, not here, not ever. That's how they were using it. It became a saying in their day. So there you go. Now you know an ancient idiom. Aren't you happy? Okay. So David conquers Jerusalem, builds a palace for himself, and then he does one more thing in this passage. You may have noticed there's a couple of battles that happen with the Philistines. Now, prior to and throughout Saul's reigns, the Philistines, which were on the western border of Israel, were a constant problem. There were just constant invasions and battles between Israel and the Philistines. And this predates Saul. You may remember the story of Samson. Samson had problems with the Philistines. He especially had problems with one Philistine, a hot babe named Delilah, who turned out to be a Philistine honey trap. The Philistines were using her to neutralize Samson. Well, because Israel and the Philistines were at war. Then Saul came in. One of the main reasons he became king was to rid Israel of the Philistine threat. Saul had some success against the Philistines, but he was never able to completely defeat them. And I think, then this is just my theory, I suspect that part of the reason was he took his eye off the ball. Saul became so obsessed with pursuing David that he focused on David more than he did on the Philistines. And the reality is, had he used David, who was a tremendous military leader and strategist, had he used David in his administration to fight against the Philistines, he probably would have defeated them. And the reason I think that is because once Saul was out of the way and David took over as king, you see these two battles that David won against the Philistines. The Philistines continued to exist after that, but they were never again a problem for Israel. David accomplished what Saul could not, and finally getting rid of this Philistine threat. So now that's what you see happen in this story, this chapter. But there's something else that happens here that I want to draw your attention to and ask a question about. And the question is this: was David better than Saul? Now, it seems like the answer to that is obvious, right? Well, of course, you know, God kicked Saul out and replaced him with David. God clearly blessed David. You even see it here in this chapter. We've seen it repeatedly in the story of David that God was with him and blessed him and everything. You think, yeah, David was way better. Saul was crazy. He was murderous. But there's something in this chapter that you may have noticed as we were reading through it that causes me some heartburn. We know that the kingdom was first taken from Saul because he failed to wait for the prophet Samuel. They were about to go into battle against the Philistines, and they were waiting for Samuel to come and offer sacrifice and ask God to be with them and to bless them. Saul got impatient, refused to wait, and he offered the sacrifices which God said he was never supposed to do. And after that, God said, "You will no longer be the king of Israel." You know, come on. It wasn't that bad. I mean, he's offering sacrifices to God. Isn't that a good thing? All he did was he didn't wait for the prophet like God said he should. It seems like kind of an administrative sort of foul, you know, that should have had an administrative kind of thing. Here's the problem. That's why God said, "You're no longer going to be the king of Israel." I want you to notice what David has done in this chapter. It says in verse 13 that once David became the king and established himself in Jerusalem, he took more wives and concubines. I want you to review here with me. Look at 2 Samuel chapter 3, verses 13 through 16. David, at this point, this was a civil war still going on, and there was a point where David began negotiating with Abner to try to end the civil war. David said, "I will make an agreement with you, but I demand one thing of you. Do not come into my presence unless you bring Michal, daughter of Saul, when you come to see me." Now, Michal, if you remember, was David's wife, but Saul had taken Michal away from David when David was on the run and given her to another man. David says, "If there's going to be peace between you, me, and the house of Saul, you need to start by bringing me Michal to be my wife again." Then David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, demanding, "Give me my wife, Michal, whom I betrothed to myself for the price of 100 Philistine foreskins." So Ish-bosheth gave orders, had her taken away from her husband Paltiel, son of Laish. Her husband, however, went with her, weeping behind her all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, "Go back." So he went back. What a sad picture that is. The guy, "I want my wife back." And David says, "No, she's mine. I want her back." Now, Hollywood would look at that and say, "Oh man, what a cool love story." David says, "I don't care about the kingdom. What I want is my wife back. I love her so much." Yeah, not quite the right picture. Because if you remember this story back in 1 Samuel 25, there was this incident where David had this run-in with this guy named Nabal. We called him Bozo. And he eventually died, and we remember that Bozo had this gorgeous wife. Well, David eventually married her. Her name was Abigail. So David has Abigail as his wife when he pulls this stunt. He says, "Well, not only Abigail, she's not good enough. I need Michal back too." Now he's got two wives. Oh, well, no, that's not quite accurate either. Something we didn't point out back in 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 43 was this. David had also married Ahinoam of Jezreel, and they were both his wives. Abigail, Ahinoam, he's got two wives, and now he wants Michal back. Now he's got three wives, and when he gets to Jerusalem, says, "Yeah, not enough. Gonna marry some more. Got a bunch more wives. Not enough. I need more mistresses." Anybody got a problem with this? Deuteronomy 17:17 says of Israel's king, "He must not take many wives." Anything about that you don't understand, David? How's David doing about that? He's not doing very well. You know, God says, "Saul, don't offer sacrifices. Wait for Samuel, and he offers sacrifice, and God says, you're no longer king. God says, David, don't take many wives, and David takes every good-looking woman on the face of the planet as his wife, and God doesn't seem to have a problem with that? Anybody here feel a little uncomfortable with this? You know, David, the history of President Clinton, among others, suggests that David probably could have managed to stay in power in the White House with all this going on. But there's not a church in this country that would have accepted him as a pastor. He's got all these women? Are you kidding me? So here's the question. How in the world can God choose that man who seems to have a real problem with marital fidelity? And we know, all of you, you've looked ahead, I know. You know what's going to happen later on? It's going to really blow up in his face. How does he choose that man over somebody who just got impatient for worshiping God? A little problem, isn't it? Here's the answer to that question. God is sovereign. This is a truth that is very difficult for us to swallow, that this story illustrates in part. Romans chapter 9, verses 14 through 18 says this. God says to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. It does not, therefore, depend on human desire or effort, but on God's mercy. For Scripture says to Pharaoh, I raised you up for this very purpose, that I might display my power in you, that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. Therefore, God has mercy on whom he wants to have mercy. Now, I want you to notice those words in verse 16. It does not depend on human desire or effort. Wow, we have trouble with that. That is so totally foreign to us. The idea of God choosing people and God loving people and God choosing to use people like David for reasons that have nothing to do with human desire or effort, I don't get that. You know why? It's because we don't get grace. It's foreign. It's hard for us to understand because our whole world operates by law. You earn it. And this idea that God is just going to choose people and it doesn't have anything to do with their desires or their effort, I have a trouble with that. Don't you? Isn't that weird? Why does God do things that way? Well, there's a very, very good reason. And you know it, you just might not be thinking about it right this moment, but if you give it a little thought, it will come to your mind pretty quickly. But I'm going to help you. I recall a time when Toby was in high school, our son. He had his driver's license, and our daughter was off to college. So we had three of us living in our house, and we had one car. So we couldn't all get to where we needed to go with one car. We needed to get another car. Well, Toby wanted us to get either a truck or an SUV so he could haul his surfboard and his hockey equipment and all that. And so we said, okay, well, we'll get an SUV. The problem for us was we were on a very limited budget. And so, you know, we weren't looking for one of those brand new, huge Nimitz class SUVs, you know. Way too expensive for us. We needed something that was like a quarter to a tenth of the price of some of those things. And so we started shopping around, and we found several possibilities, but they all had something in common. And what they had in common was they weren't perfect. They all had something wrong with them, every one of them, and usually there were several things wrong with them. In our budget category, perfection simply wasn't on the menu. Now, we ended up buying this older Jeep Cherokee, which seemed like it would be a great vehicle for him. It had everything that he needed, and it was just great, except for one minor flaw, and that was it broke down with consistency that is just beyond belief. But here's the problem. If you go shopping for places where there are only clunkers, you should not be surprised if you get a clunker. Here's the thing. When God goes shopping for people to choose and to use in his plan, all that's there are clunkers. It's all he's got to choose from. Let me ask you a question. How many perfect people do you know? Now, I am married to a woman who is as close to perfection as it gets. But I can assure you that if you are in the car with her when she's driving and there is another driver who aggravates her, her reaction is not one that you would call perfect. You know, it's, you know, she doesn't go into road rage, but, you know, it's not necessarily the most loving thing in the planet, you know. None of us are perfect. We're all clunkers. That's the problem. There's this theme that runs through the Bible that, you know, every now and then you'll notice it, but we forget about it. God has these great heroes of the faith that he uses. There's Noah, you know, saved from the flood and celebrates by getting drunk and disgracing himself. Kind of clunker class behavior, you know? Then there's Abraham, who showed appalling cowardice and dishonesty and compromised his wife on not one but two occasions, and then went along with this cockamamie scheme to have a son by sleeping with one of the servants. Clunker class behavior all the way around. Jacob, one of the great heroes of the faith, was an inveterate con man who scammed his own father and his own brother, among others. Moses murdered a man, definitely a clunker class offense, before being used by God. Gideon was an idolater. Really? Yeah. Samson was great, except he went brain dead when he was around a hot woman, you know? And it just goes on and on and on. Well, yeah, but you get to the New Testament. Then we got the disciples, yeah, who were obsessed with which one of them is the greatest and most famous. Really? And then Peter going, everybody else may fail you, but I never will. Ew, man, clunker behavior right there. Oh, Paul, he's a great one. Yeah, he said, I am the chief of sinners, which being translated is, if the clunkers were electing a president, he'd be it, because he persecuted people of God. God sovereignly decides to use some of the clunkers. Now, you might say, well, how is that right and fair? Well, in Romans chapter 9, verse 20, Paul answers that question. He says, who are you, a human being, to talk back to God? Shall what is formed say to the one who formed it, why did you make me like this? You know, the paraphrase of that is, it's above your pay grade. Why? How is that fair, God? You know what? I don't like his answer because it sounds an awful lot like one of the parental cliches. Because I said so. But here's the problem. He's right in making that statement because we cannot understand why God does what he does. You know, Lori and I occasionally take care of Toby and Anna's dogs, Doc and Banjo. Doc is an Australian shepherd who is smart. He has an amazingly sweet disposition and is in desperate need of Valium. Dog is, he just is, to say he's hyperactive would be kind of like saying, you know, the surface of the sun gets a tad warm. This dog is bananas. And one of the things about him that is just mysterious is he has a huge problem with people taking a shower. You know, you get ready to take a shower and he somehow knows, you're going to take a shower. And he freaks out. He starts barking and running in circles and going crazy, and he's got to protect you from the evil shower, you know. And I sat him down. I said, Doc, you got to understand here. Showers are good. Showers are helpful. They're not harmful. He doesn't get it. He doesn't understand because he can't understand. But he's a lot closer to being able to understand what a human being does and why than we are to being able to understand what God does and why. And God says, you don't need to understand, you just need to trust. Now, there's a great aspect to this message. In Romans chapter 3, verses 3 and 4, Paul wrote, "What if some were unfaithful? Will their unfaithfulness nullify God's faithfulness? Not at all. Let God be true and every human being a liar." In other words, Paul's saying, yeah, but we fail, and isn't our failure going to mess God's plan up? And Paul says, no, God's going to be faithful to his promises because it doesn't depend on human beings. Now, I think that's great news because I find personally it's very easy to get down on myself and to get discouraged because I can do spiritually exactly what I do with those people, those physical athletes in the commercial. I can start thinking about, I ought to be like this spiritually. I get this image and I think, I need to be like that. I need to, and then I just don't even get close to that image. And you start getting discouraged. And you know what? I know Christians who go to the extreme, striving mightily to improve themselves so they can convince themselves and others that they are making progress and they're not clunkers anymore. Here's the bad news. On their best day, the most spiritual Christians on the planet are still clunkers. They may have a new coat of paint, but underneath, they're clunkers. Here's the simple reality. If they could be anything other than a clunker, Jesus did not need to die on a cross. He died there because we are clunkers from the word go, and we can never make ourselves something other than that. The great news is this means the pressure is off. We can be at peace with God because Jesus has died and risen from the dead for us, and we are forgiven, we are loved, we are accepted. And God says, I am going to even use you in my plan, clunker that you may be. And here's the even better news. God is the great restorer of clunkers. He says he is going to restore us and make us new. You know, the interesting thing, every now and then, you'll encounter around here restored vehicles, and they look beautiful, don't they? You know, they're all shiny, and they look like they belong in a showroom someplace. And when you see that, you don't realize that thing back in the day could have been a clunker. It's been all of its parts have been replaced, and everything works now, and it's all shiny. That is what God is going to do for us, and he's in the process right now. So we can rejoice that God loves us. We can admit our flaws. We can accept that we don't need to be defeated by them. We can do what David did, which is to present himself to God to be used by him in his plan to the best of his ability. Understanding that God's choosing of him wasn't based on his ability to be something other than the clunker that he was. So the question then is, how do we respond? What should we do in light of this? Well, first of all, I think we should admit that it's not up to us to gain God's approval or make ourselves good enough to somehow be used by him. One of the great pressures that Christians continually face, you know, we continually tell ourselves, I gotta somehow measure up. I've got to get God to, you know, approve me. But that approach to life has some huge downsides. Recently at one of our Anchorman breakfasts that we have on Saturday morning, the guys, one of the guys mentioned he'd seen a television show about the building of the old Twin Towers of the World Trade Center before they were knocked down. And he talked about seeing those iron workers, they were building those buildings, working on these girders 1,000 feet in the air, and talking about how these guys would walk along these girders with no safety strap, you know, no, I'm like, huh? just thinking about that makes me ill. It's like, can you imagine you're 1,000 feet up and you're on this girder, you know, this wide, walking along, and you think, if I make one misstep, So here's the thing. How relaxing of a job is that, do you suppose? Yikes! I mean, it would be stressful to the max. Well, you know, if we're going through life and we have to maintain ourselves in such a way that God would approve of us and try to earn his acceptance, then our life is going to be like that. We're going to be walking along and every moment presents another possibility to make a misstep and disaster is going to occur. And the last thing that we're going to experience is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, the fruit of the Spirit of knowing God. Furthermore, what happens is that we know we really can't make ourselves good enough for God and to prove him. And so what do? Well, we have to hide. We have to pretend. You know, maybe in the inside you're a clunker, but slap some paint on that thing to make it look a little better. Does that change anything? No, it doesn't change anything. All you can do is hide, which means it's exhausting, and you're never going to actually be able to focus on loving other people. You can't get that close to them or they'll see the truth. What a relief it is to just admit, okay, I'm a clunker. But it doesn't stop God from loving me and using me. That's amazing. I'm free now, which we'll get to in a moment. Second thing it does for us is it means that we should accept. I think it's interesting that we have very high standards in the church, and you know, in some ways we should, but David wouldn't have measured up to our standards today, but God used him anyway. All of us are clunkers. There's not one of us that's worthy of that prime spot in the great dealer's showroom where you would say, wow, here you go. This is perfect. The hope for us is in God's grace to us. And so when we look at one another, we need to be very gentle with how we regard each other. And not just us here, but everyone in the world. I mean, you know, does it make sense for an old beat-up Ford Pinto to be looking over at some 25-year-old Nissan Sentra and saying, what a piece of junk that thing is, you know? Yeah, dude, you're a Ford Pinto, come on, you know? The hope for us is the same. Several years ago, Lori and I were on vacation, and this one afternoon, or one morning actually, we were out and we were watching some people who were stand-up paddleboarding, and they were not doing very well. And you know, Lori and I, we're not pros at that, but we've done it a few times, and we've kind of gotten to where we're okay, we're pretty good at it. And so I'm watching these people, and I'm just kind of smugly thinking, "Wow, they suck," you know. they're not good at this at all, and oh, he's doing this wrong, he's doing that wrong, you know, and I'm kind of critiquing them. Well, a little bit later, we went out stand-up paddleboarding. What I had failed to notice was there was quite a big swell running this particular. I hadn't even tuned into this fact. And the stand-up paddleboards we got were maybe just a little bit smaller, shorter than they should have been. And we got out there, and man, oh man, I started flailing all over the place, like crazy, falling down. I was making those people look good. You know, it was awful. And, you know, some of you remember, I fell down and scraped my leg on a coral head. That later got infected. I ended up with a scar there for a couple of years. You know what? After that little session, I came in and I saw some other people out there, and I was a lot more sensitive to their struggles. Like, yeah, I feel your pain out there. You know, when I realized I'm not really all that either, it changes how I view other people, isn't it? Doesn't that happen? Doesn't that change how we think about others? We see all these people and go, yep, clunker, just like me. God has shown me grace, and that changes everything. So, one last thing we should do, and that is aspire. You know, 2 Corinthians 3:17 is one of Lori's and my favorite verses. That's where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. Here's the thing. God has come and he said, yep, you're a clunker, but I'm going to restore you and I'm going to love you and I'm going to use you. And so now we're like, we're set free. We don't have anything left to prove. We don't have anything that we have to fear. We are set free to just go for it. And that's one of the things that I love about David is, you know what? The guy made some awful mistakes and he had some huge blind spots. But you know what? He says, one thing I ask the Lord, that I may dwell in his house forever. And I may behold his beauty. I want to serve God. I want to know God. I'm going to go after that with everything that is within me. And that's what we can aspire to as well. We're free. We don't have anything left to prove. We don't have anything left to defend. We don't have to be threatened by anything. We don't have anything left to fear. We can just say, God, in his grace, has accepted me and has, for whatever reason that's beyond my comprehension, has chosen to love me, and he wants to use me even now. And so what I can do is just let it rip. And like David, pursue him with all my heart and say, God, what I want more than anything else in this life is to know you, love you, serve you, and glorify you. We're free. Let's go after it with all our hearts. Let's pray. Father, kind of a strange thing to see David, who we've always known as a man after God's own heart, and see him making decisions that were just awful. And yet we know somewhere underneath all of that was a man who understood that you loved him, and that you are his rock. And as a man after your own heart, what he wanted more than anything else was to do your will. Even when he failed to do it, somewhere in there he wanted to do it. Lord, help us to realize that we're like David. We're recipients of grace more than anything else in life. In Jesus Christ, that's what we are. And in your grace, Father, help us to just be free, admit the truth about ourselves, not try to prove anything, but to see others as people who are in need of your grace, and then just to let it rip, to aspire with all of our hearts, to live in the freedom of the Spirit, and to pursue your will and your glory with everything that is within us. We pray this in the name of our great Lord Jesus. Amen.